you're all awake now. Is he going to be one of these who rattles on for 45 minutes, an hour and a half? What's going to happen? Well, on the way to church tonight, I was remembering the very first time I ever preached in the church where I was training for the ministry. And I asked the minister of the church the first time I went up, how long should I preach for? And he said, preach as long as you like, but remember, we're all going home in 30 minutes. So I will bear that in mind and try not to transgress. I've got a couple of texts I'd like to read to you. One is slightly longer than the other. The first one is from the book of Psalms, and it's Psalm number 40. Psalm 40, the first three verses, says, I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog. I don't know, miry bog always sounds like a district of Wigan to me for some reason. And set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. A couple of phrases to bear in mind for the sermon. First of one is that he says he put a new song in my lips. And the other one is he plucked me up from that district of Wigan, the miry bog. Bear that in mind as we go on. The other text I'd like to read to you is a very famous text from the Gospel of Mark about the death of Jairus' daughter. Now this is a bit longer, but please, if you're not used to reading long passages of the Bible, this is a tale and a half. You've never read a tale like this one before. So concentrate on what I'm saying, concentrate on what Jesus did, and ask yourself, how strange is this story? And this is the true one. This really happened. Mark chapter 5, verse 21. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. And he, Jesus, he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I will be made well. And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing around you. Here they are telling Jesus off. You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, who touched me? Are you crazy? That's what they're thinking. And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead. She's sleeping. And they laughed at him. So he got told off and laughed at in one paragraph. So they laughed at him, but he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kumai, which means, little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. Now there's a long tale, but what a tale. So, what are we going to talk about tonight? Well, this is a message that I've entitled God's Triage. God's Triage. You know what triage is? If you're ever like me, have an accident and go to the hospital, the nurse yanks you into a cubicle and prods you and pokes you to see how loud you scream, and then she decides whether it's serious or not so serious. Do you need to see a doctor, or can you sit and wait for a couple of hours and you'll be fine? Now here is Jesus doing triage. He's working out his time, deciding which is the most important case to see now, who can wait. And from our point of view, it seems to me he got everything back to front. Let's have a look at this. It has long been said that God has three answers to prayer. Answer one is yes, and he does it right now. Answer number two is no, that is not good for you. I am not answering that prayer. And answer number three, excuse me, is not yet. Now, if you're anything like me, you know that little children sometimes do not understand the difference between no and not yet. If you ask them to wait, the same reaction comes as if you say no, you're not having it. Children do not like to wait. They want everything now. And with God, we find that most of us are not that much more mature than little children. If God says wait, we think, oh, he's not answering my prayer. I give up. I'm going to join a different religion. Unfortunately, like little children, we often confuse the last two. Now, there's a strange theology, and I've had face-to-face encounters with this, and if you want to ask me about some of them after church, I'll tell you, but I will not say anything from the pulpit. But there is a strange theology grown up over the past 50 or 60 years, that somehow, if we ask God the right way, God will give us everything that we ask for when we ask for it. If we just learn a correct method of prayer, and we say amen at the right place, and we add in Jesus' name, and we believe enough, whatever we ask God to do, God's going to do it. Somehow, God has become the great vending machine in the sky, and if you only have the right coin and push the right button, you'll get whatever you ask for. But in this story, we see things going a little bit differently from that. There's a danger with getting everything that you want to when you ask for it. Have you ever heard of King Midas? Have you ever heard that name? The legend goes, the ancient Greek tale goes, that he rescued the satyr Silenus. And Silenus said, I will give you whatever you want. And Midas said, oh, I know what I want. I want that everything I touch turns to gold. Can you imagine what that would be like? Oh, I will bless you with a golden pulpit. Just what you've always wanted. Just touch it, it becomes gold. Now, that sounds like a wonderful thing to have. Anything I touch will become gold. I'll be a billionaire overnight. Now, the Chinese have a proverb that says, be careful what you wish for or you just might get it. Now, can you imagine if everything you touch turns to gold, what's going to happen when you pick up your next hamburger? Or a banana? Or any food that you want to touch? Ooh, it's going to break your teeth. Can you imagine every cup of drink that you pick up, suddenly, oh, I can't drink it. And finally, the story goes on that after Midas discovered he couldn't eat and couldn't drink, he reached out to his daughter and asked her for help, touched her, and she turned to gold. And he no longer had a daughter. There's a danger in getting everything that you want. Now, where are we going with this? Sometimes God says to us, not yet, wait. Now, our society that we live in is not designed to instill patience into anybody. We don't live in a patient society. Basically, in our society, the truth is, you really can have anything, anytime that you want it. How many payday loan adverts do you see on daytime TV as you watch it? Oh, I don't have the money right now. But apparently, if I phone this number, the money I need to buy what I want right now will be in my bank account 20 minutes after I hang the phone up. Great. When you come home hungry, you no longer have to think, oh, how can I make a meal? When I'm hungry, all I do is reach out to the microwave, shove something in it, and bing! 5 minutes later, I'm eating hot food. Or if I can't be bothered doing that, I'll just get on the internet and Just go on justeat.co.uk and get something delivered from the local takeaway. I don't even have to pick the phone up anymore. It's just so easy to get what you want when you want it. My superstar son here, Xander, who is a marvellous boy. Isn't he handsome, everybody? I remember when he was 2 years old, sometimes he would get so tired and he knew he needed something, but he couldn't think what he wanted. He would sit there and say, I want. And he couldn't finish the sentence. He didn't know what he wanted. He just knew he wanted something. And he needed it right now. And that's the society we live in. Want, and want it now. Now, here in our story, we need to ask a question. When I used to say to my little boy, Xander, no, you can't have it right now. You need to wait. I hope that he trusted me, that what I promised him he was going to get next week, he was going to get. Jairus needed something from Jesus, and he needed it right now. He said to Jesus, my daughter is at the point of death. She's about to die. I need a miracle, and I need it right now. He was a marvelous picture. We know that Jairus was a ruler in the synagogue. He was at the top of his society. He was up there in the community. Everyone respected him, kept the distance from him. They knew who he was. And here is a Galilean carpenter, a house builder. A rough man has come to town. And Jairus, it says, is kneeling at the feet of a carpenter. A leader in society is kneeling at the feet of a brickie, saying, I need a miracle right now. And it looks as though his prayer is about to be answered in exactly the way he hoped. Jesus said to him, where do you live? He said, I'm coming with you right now. You're going to get your miracle. Wouldn't Christianity be a wonderful thing if it always worked out like that? If prayer was always answered the way we chose. In our psalm, back in Psalm number 40, I've meditated on this one many times and I've reached a conclusion. It says, he drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog. I have always felt in my life that God seems to have a habit of waiting till I'm in the miry bog, the pit of destruction, and at that point he decides to answer my prayer. Wouldn't Christianity be a much easier faith if God didn't wait until we were at the bottom of the pit in the mud singing, help! When life was free and easy and everything was going fine, God just did wonderful things for us then. And we never got into that sticky predicament that we seem to be so easy at getting into. Wouldn't you prefer it if God answered prayer before you ended up in the miry bog or the pit of destruction? Or in my case, both of them. But oh no, with Jairus, Jesus decides to go on a diversion. This is where he does his triage. He's going through the crowd with Jairus, trying to get to his daughter before his daughter dies, and somebody touches him. And he feels power go out of him. He knows something is happening. And he stops. This woman with the issue of blood, when it says that, and I'll say this only once, instead of common pulpit phrase, she has menstrual problems. Just in case you're reading the story thinking, what's going on here? She has serious problems that way. It's what we brothers call the sisters' problems. You know, it's women's problems. We'll just leave it at that. We don't want to talk about any more than that. So that's been said from the pulpit. You don't hear that often. At this point, the woman with the issue of blood catches Jesus' attention, and we don't know how long he spent chatting to her, sitting with her, holding her hand, reassuring her, healing her. But all we know is he did it for so long that Jairus' daughter actually died. And people come through the crowd saying, oh, leave the teacher alone. She's dead. It's all over. There's nothing he can do. Now, after the introduction to this passage, Jairus doesn't say anything. If you read it again, you'll see Jairus falls silent. He doesn't say another word at this point. Now, we can imagine why. He's probably thinking, my heart went, boom, he's going to heal her. And then, bang, he's the Messiah. He's the Saviour. I don't get it. What's going on? Why is he talking to this woman? She has problems, I know, but not as bad as dying. Only a man can say that, I know that. But, you know, What's going on? Why is he talking to her? We don't know what Jairus was thinking. We can only speculate and guess, but he's probably thinking, I've lost everything now. My daughter's dead. He could have done something, but he didn't do it. Now, Jesus says to him, don't worry. We're still going to go to your house. It's going to be okay. She's going to be fine. Now, when he arrives at the house, we see the compassion of Christ. There was something that we don't really have in our society that went on in those days. Leaders in society, if somebody died in the immediate family, they'd hire what they call the professional mourners. If you had money, you wanted to have a big, all singing, all dancing funeral. And even before the funeral, you'd hire people to come and play music and to weep and wail in your house. And the one with the loudest wailers was called Bob Marley. No, not him. The one with the loudest wailers was showing that they had real influence in society. So when they got to the house, there'd be people, all this noise would be going on. And the crowd heard this as they followed Jesus, thinking, wow, that's going to be a funeral. They've got all these people weeping and wailing. And Jesus walks in, looks around at them and says, what's all the noise about? What's all this weeping and wailing? She's only sleeping, that's all. She's just asleep. Now we see how deep and how sincere the mourners were. They got their shekel, their pieces of silver, for weeping and wailing at the right time. Because as soon as they heard this, they went, ha! What? They switched off the wailing and the weeping, and they started laughing at Jesus. Ah, is she sleeping? Listen, we're professionals. We've done this week after week after week. That's a stiff, not a sleeping girl. She's dead. Rigor mortis is setting in. Can you see? She's dead, 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 dead. You say she's sleeping? How deep and how sincere the mourning was. It turned to laughter in a second. Because there was no heart in it. They were there for the money. They were there for the prestige. They weren't really involved in the mourning. Now what's going on? They'd seen death many times. Now I want to tell you something about the society we live in. We are surrounded by professional mourners. People who are negative to the eyeballs. When you tell them that your life is going to change, they know you. They know you've had bad habits all your life. You've been aggressive, vulgar, in debt, overspending, blah, 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 blah. This is you. And you come home on one day and say, you know what? I believe Jesus Christ is going to change me. What? What are you on this time? Have you been drinking again? Jesus is going to change my life. Yeah, right. That can't happen. We've heard all this before. We are surrounded by people who know failure. They know death. They know ruin when they see it. And they will tell us that there is no hope. There's no hope for our society. There's no hope for Lee. There's no hope for you, for your children, for your family. They've seen it all before. They are professionals. And they are professional negative speakers. They will tell you that this is the end and all is ruin. But in the midst of people speaking negatively, saying all is ruin, nothing can ever change, there comes a carpenter who reaches out a gentle hand, takes hold of yours, whispers in your ear and says, Talitha kumai. Little boy, little girl, get up. Talitha kumai. Talitha is a diminutive form. Well, we would often say in our society, sweetheart, darling, darling, get up. He's speaking to a child of 12. And that is exactly how he speaks to us today. It is an overflow of Jesus' humanity. He's remembering what he heard on his mother's knee. This is how his mother would have spoken to him as she raised him. This is the humanity of Christ as well as his divinity speaking to us saying, I know you're feeling bad. I know things are rough. I know they tell you you can never change. I know they tell you life is cruel. There is no hope for you. There is no future. The whole world is organized to keep you down. But listen to me. I am the King of Kings. I am the Lord of Lords. I am the eternal one who created heaven and earth. And I'm reaching out to you saying to you, Talitha Kumai, get up! The whole world is against you, but fear not. I have overcome the world. He has overcome death. He has overcome sin. He has overcome the cross. And all those things they say to you, you can never overcome, He has already overcome them for you. And you can stand up and walk. I'm going to rush. I promise you I won't keep you too long. I'm only halfway through, so I'll have to rush the second half. Let's turn to the woman. The woman with the discharge of blood. What is it about this woman as Jesus walked through the crowd to rescue a girl that he knew was dying? Why was it he stopped to speak to a woman who had female problems? I cannot say that word again from the pulpit. Why did he do it? In our modern world, this may have seemed she had a minor problem. But she'd had this problem for 12 years. And in Jewish society, it was a much bigger problem than we would say today. At that time of the month, for the woman, in Jewish society, according to the law of Moses, she was not allowed to have physical contact with any other human being. When she was bleeding, she mustn't touch another person. Now remember, if she did, there could be a court trial and she could be put out of society forever. The person that she touched, they could be declared unclean and they could be put out of society too. Then that meant every time she went to the high street, whenever she walked through the town, she had to carry a sign around her neck telling people not to touch her. This was a public problem. And this means that for 12 years, she had been starved of physical human contact. She hadn't touched a person for 12 years. She wasn't allowed to. She wasn't allowed to have guests in her home. She had to live alone year after year after year. And all of a sudden, she saw Jesus coming to town. And what does she do? She takes off the sign. As far as we know, there's no mention of any sign. And she pushed physically through the crowd. She was not allowed to touch people. But instead of keeping that law, she saw the compassion of Christ. She saw the one that she knew would love her. And she physically pushed people out of the way, breaking every law in the book, and got to Jesus. And Jesus felt power go out of him when finally she touched God himself. It said she'd been tormented by doctors. The Jewish doctors had a law in those days, a prescription in those days, that if somebody had the problem she had to sit over 7 trenches of burning vine cuttings while holding a cup of wine. This was the prescription for her problem. 7 burning trenches she had to sit over. Hoorah! Doesn't that sound nice? More like a superstition. And what does Jesus do? Jesus knows in our story there are 2 kinds of people he wasn't allowed to touch. He wasn't allowed to touch the dead. Who does he touch? The dead 12-year-old girl. He wasn't allowed to touch the unclean. Who does he touch? The woman with the issue of blood. All the laws of men are put aside. And all the problems that we have, our separation from God, our separation from society, our internal problems that we say are too much for us, God breaks through and touches all the people that society says he can never touch. We see 2 desperate situations, death and sickness, tears and human pain. And when we ask the question, what is salvation? What is the answer? What is salvation? What do we say? In our modern society, in our modern churchianity, we think, oh, salvation is all about getting forgiven and a home in heaven. It's about having a personal relationship with God. Yes, it is all those things, but it's a lot more than that. Salvation is more than just a personal relationship with Jesus, wonderful as that is, and please, don't say I'm putting that down in any way. Now, I'm sure that when somebody touched Jesus, being Jesus, he could have figured out who touched him. He could have known. He said to the disciples, "Who touched me?" Why? Why did he ask the question? It's all because when he spotted the woman and called her to him, he asked her about her story. He said, "What's happened to you?" And it says that she confessed everything to him. Not only was she forgiven her sins, not only was she healed in her body, she was invited to make a full public confession as to what she had done. She said, "I'm not supposed to touch anybody. I've touched all these people. I'm not supposed to touch anybody, and I've touched you." And instead of saying, "Oh, you've broken the law now, off you go," what does he say to her? "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Go in shalom. Go in wholeness. I am restoring you back to society. Now you're going to fit in. Your personality is going to be reinforced and made whole. Your character is going to be reinforced. You are back to where you were. You are a whole person with a full societal relationship. You can go back to your home and everything is going to be the way it should be for you." Salvation is more than just a personal relationship with Jesus. When you become a Christian, you join a new society. You come back with your reputation restored, just like that woman. It can take a long time before people recognize it, but this can really happen. I want to tell you a quick story before I finish about somebody I know. And this is what struck me as the miracles that God can do in a person's life. About 25 years ago, I was pioneering my first church in a part of Manchester, and I was given a contact with an evangelist who could come and visit my church. And this fella came from California, never met him before, but I'd heard he was really good at evangelism. So he came to me, and I didn't know him. In fact, I can't remember his name, that's a shame of it all. I can't even remember what his name was. But he arrived in my church, and when he was preaching, the only thing I could think was, "What happened to you?" He had this massive scar down his head here, like a groove had been cut in his skull, and it was all dented in. And he preached the first night in church, and good. And I was itching to ask him, "What happened to your head?" That's all I was thinking about. Second night he preached, and I think, went out for a curry, and I still couldn't find the guts. Well, the third night, I thought, this is the last night he's preaching. If I don't ask him now, I will never find out what happened to his head. So we were crossing the road in Woodley in Stockport, heading towards a curry house. And at the traffic light, I said to him, "I'm sorry, I don't know you that well, but I have to ask you, what's the story with your head?" I said, "Oh, brother," he said. "Before I became a Christian," he said, "I had a problem with methamphetamines." He was on meth, you know, this Breaking Bad program that's on the TV. He was one of those characters. And the police raided his house, and they took all of his supplies and all this kind of stuff, and he got really angry. So he decided, now this is America, that what he was going to do was get his own back on the local constabulary. So he decided to go and get a gun and walk into the police station, high on drugs, and shoot some policemen. Now remember, this is America. Every policeman carries a gun. And he walked straight into the police station, pulled out a gun, and got shot in the head before he could even shoot him. Was put into hospital. They did restoration surgery on his head, put his brain back together, whatever they did. He survived, came out of the hospital thinking, "I need to put my life together," walked into church, and became a Christian. And now he's an evangelist. I know that's a dramatic story. But all I could think when he told me this, I didn't cross the road. He was going across the road telling this while I'm hanging onto the lamppost thinking, "What? I'm British. These things don't happen in my country." All I can say is he reached the very lowest point a human being can. He's a drug dealer carrying a gun, making drugs, wanted to shoot policemen. He's as low as a human being can get in our estimation. And God loved him. I can't even remember his name, I'm sorry. This was 25 years ago. God loved him. And God healed him. Saved his life. Saved his soul. Gave him a position in society. He became an evangelist. That's what God can do. That's what God did to the woman with the issue of blood. That's what God did with Jairus' daughter. That's what God did with Jairus, as far as we know. How would Jairus react to seeing his daughter raised from the dead? God changes lives. God restores reputations. God could repair society. And all those people around you say, lives can't change. You tell them they're wrong. Lives really can change. And they can stay changed and be changed for eternity. And so can our societies. God bless you.